Fantastic. All right, it's recording. Fantastic. All right, yeah, I still have this on. So tonight we're going to learn about someone who, I mean, without hyperbole, like we've spoken about a lot of great rabbis. As I'm sure you guys know, I know I always quote this all the time, but like we spoke about Rav Ovadia. I continue going on and on about Rav Ovadia. We spoke about Moshe Feinstein. I could continue on and on about Moshe Feinstein. We spoke about the Chazon Ish. We can just continue and continue and continue. But there's really no one who's more important in America than the figure that we see over here, Rav Aaron Cutler. Not one person who had nearly as much of an impact as Rav Aaron Cutler. So tonight what I'd like to learn why exactly was his impact so great? What made him so special? What made him different? And how exactly is that being manifested today? And when people talk about the history of Judaism in America, so obviously it starts off with 1654 with Sherith Israel, with the Jews coming from Recife, and really beautiful, the Sherith Israel congregation on 70th and Central Park West. And then you could talk about Turo, and you could talk about all sorts of other old school things. But when people really start talking about Orthodoxy in America, it really begins with two people. Number one is Rav Aaron Cutler. The other one is Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, who himself, he was the person who started a yeshiva called Torah V'Das. And especially if you look at all of these, you know, art scroll biographies, I'll say it's like in that section of like the library, if you look at those, it'll be like, yeah, before then there was nothing in America, it was a barren wasteland, until these two great Gedolim, they were the ones that really started everything. Before then it was really nothing. Is that true? Not necessarily, but, I mean, most certainly we'll see. However, they differed tremendously. You can't have two people more different than Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Shraga Feivel. What do I mean by that? Rav Shraga Feivel, if you just even just take a look at this, this was actually something that J.J. Schaffner actually uncovered. He actually uncovered this in the archives of the New York State Comptroller, something very cool like that, and he found that Torah V'Das was originally supposed to be Torah V'Das. What's Das, or Dot if you're smarty like me? Knowledge, exactly. But not necessarily just regular knowledge. Not necessarily just regular knowledge. It's talking about knowledge like college. In terms of, they actually tried making a charter, Torah V'Das, tried making a charter to become a college, very much like Yeshiva University. It ended up failing, but like what most people have no idea about is that that's really what the Das was supposed to be. But yeah, Rav Aaron Cutler was the absolute total opposite. Total opposite. He said that there's absolutely no pshara, there's absolutely no there's no approach that you could absolutely take where it would involve college in the slightest. And we're going to see about this. We're going to see about this a lot. It's really funny because like if Torah V'Das would have become that way, I mean, it would have been a whole different history in terms of, you know, they encourage people to go to college at night, but would Torah V'Das, would they be said in the same, we're going to talk a lot about YU, would they be said in the same breath as YU, which isn't necessarily in the more, you know, Haredi, in the more yeshiva circles, not necessarily as respected. So most of the shiur tonight comes from an amazing article, really, really good article, by a professor from Beit Shemesh. His name is Yoel Finkelman. Really, really tremendous article. The article is called Haredi Isolation in Changing Environment, A Case Study in Yeshiva Immigration. And what he does, he actually is famous for writing another book. He wrote a book called Kosher Reading. It actually just came out 2 years ago. Four years ago. And it's a book all about Haredi publishers like Art Scroll and how exactly they publish things. We're going to discuss also a lot about this because in the life of Rav Aaron, there is a lot of, you know, going back and looking at the sources and, you know, tinkering with a few stuff, which we're going to see. Part of it's going to relate a little bit to Stalin, which, you know, not in a good way, obviously. Okay, so let's talk about Rav Aaron Cutler. So, one more thing about this article. This article was written a few years ago. So when he writes in the article about Lakewood Yeshiva, there were 1,500 students in Lakewood Yeshiva. This article was written about 10 years ago. Since then, there's right now 6 to 7,000, Baruch Hashem, students learning in Lakewood Yeshiva. My brother-in-law's learned there. It's an amazing, amazing place to go to. In fact, as we'll discuss in a little bit, it was a resort town. And in fact, it wasn't just a resort town just for Orthodox people. In fact, quite the opposite. There was quite a lot of Reform synagogues, quite a lot of conservative synagogues, all over. And what happened was that since then, since, you know, basically the 70s and 80s, just 2 years ago, the last Reform temple in Lakewood got transformed into a 400-seat Beit Midrash for the Lakewood yeshiva, which is like out of this world. And we'll talk about how exactly they get their money, which is fascinating and really, really interesting, but we'll get into that. So before we get into all of that, let's move on. So basically, where does all yeshivot start? All yeshivot obviously start at Volozhin, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, the Talmid of the Vilna Gaon, comes up with a great idea. How are we going to insulate ourselves from Haskalah? How are we going to keep ourselves away from the outside influences? Let's start a scholar's yeshiva, a yeshiva for the best people anywhere. What had always happened before is that you would basically learn in your shtetl. If you were great, you would basically outlearn your Rebbe, and basically you're stuck. In terms of, you could try to go ahead, and if you had money, you could go ahead and hire a Melamed who would be better. It was very, very, very difficult to basically have any sort of upward mobility. What Volozhin changed is that there became one center that everybody wanted to go to. And almost every single gadol from that previous generation either taught there. So we're talking about people like Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. We're talking about Rav Kook, for example. The Netziv taught there. The Beit Halevi taught there. We're talking about the greatest rabbis. It was the producer of the greatest rabbis of that generation by far. And one great, great rabbi was a rabbi named Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was a tremendous, tremendous tzaddik. Very, very big tzaddik. And he learned in Volozhin. They tell a very funny story. I like this story. I'll tell it. I mean, hopefully you guys, it's a nice joke. I like it, but it's bad when you tell something is a joke. I apologize. Man, the tiredness. So basically what happened was that Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer learned in Volozhin, and he was extremely, extremely close to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to speak to people. He used to put his arm around them. He was very, very chummy. Like, they used to like play boxing. He used to play boxing with the students, which is fascinating. But basically, he used to hold Rav Isser Zalman. Rav Isser Zalman was pretty tall. He used to hold him like this, and he used to discuss Torah going up and down the streets of Volozhin, going back and forth. So he was also a Talmud, Rav Isser Zalman. He was also a Talmud of the Netziv, Rav Tali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. So he was a little bit upset about this. He said, what's happening? Rav Chaim is dominating this Eloi, this Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. He's dominating his time. Where is he going to go out and learn Torah? What exactly is the joke? There's a Gemara in Kiddushin that discusses a machloket. What is a person supposed to do? Is a person supposed to learn Torah first and then get married? Or get married and then learn Torah? So what the Gemara says, it says a person should get married and then learn Torah. No, the opposite. A person should learn Torah and then get married. What's the reasoning behind that? So the Gemara writes, it says, Rechayim al tzavaro v'yasuk b'torah. What that means is, a person's going to have a yoke on his shoulders. The yoke of parnasah, the yoke of trying to sustain himself and learn Torah, it's going to be impossible. So therefore, you should learn when he has the chance and then get married later. So the Netziv said about Rav Chaim and Rav Isser Zalman about their relationship, he said, Rav Chaim al tzavaro v'yasuk b'torah. Rav Chaim is hanging on his shoulder, and you're expecting him to go ahead and learn Torah? That's something very, very, very difficult for him to do. So how exactly does a lot of this stuff start? Let's actually go back even before then. So what happened was, Volozhin was this great yeshiva. Unfortunately, as we know, Volozhin gets shut down 1892 or 94, I'm totally forgetting, I think 92. And what happened was, Volozhin yeshiva gets shut down. Other yeshivas end up basically picking up the slack. So you end up with the biggest one, which is going to be the most important one, which is going to be Slobodka. And Slobodka actually is really two different yeshivot. One of them is named Beis Yitzchak, which is named after the primary greatest rabbi of the time, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. And one of them was called Beit Yisrael, which was named after the great Musar personality, which was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And they both had very, very different ways of teaching. One way was very, very much not Musar oriented, and the other way was extremely Musar oriented. The head of the Beis Yisrael branch was the Alter Mislabadka. His name was Rav Nassim Svi Finkel. In fact, the former Rosh Yeshiva is named after him, the former Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Mir, who actually just passed away. I don't know if anyone saw the video. It's a fantastic video put out by Art Scroll. Really, really good. So Rav Nassim Svi Finkel, he ends up starting this whole yeshiva called Slobodka, and he's in charge of it. He's in charge of this yeshiva. And it goes through a lot of different mutations, going to different places. It's really interesting. So there was a great, great rabbi named the Ribaz. The Ribaz. In fact, when we first started like divvying up the shiurim, Rabbi Moskowitz, he wrote me, he says, I'm going to talk about the Radbaz. So when I read it, I was reading it very fast, and I'm like, oh, the Ribaz. So I read him. I'm like, I have so much information for you on the Ribaz. And he writes me back. He's like, oh, it's the Radbaz. I'm like, oh, no, because like it's sad. Who is the Ribaz? The Ribaz was Rav Yaakov David Wilovsky. He was fascinating. He's mainly known for his foray into being the chief rabbi of Chicago, and he had to leave on a Friday night, hidden in a like wagon and like a crazy. It's this crazy story. If you guys want to see it, there's a great book that was put out a couple years ago by I think even Harvard Press, which is called Kosher. Really fantastic story about basically kosherists in America, written by a not Jewish person. It's really fascinating. So what happened was is that the Ribaz was the chief rabbi of Chicago. He tried reforming kosherists, and the butcher said, "If you still remain here after Shabbos, we are going to kill you." And they were not joking around, because he was obviously cutting into their parnassah. So that Friday night, he gets a non-Jewish person, and he actually leaves Chicago, and he actually ends up going to Sfat. And he's very, very important because of the influence he had on the rabbis in Europe. Because he wrote a Sefer on Chumash. And in the introduction to the Ribaz's Sefer on Chumash, he writes that America is a horrible, horrible, horrible place. And he says any rabbis that try to go there, try to do anything good, are going to end up fleeing on a Friday night, running away for their lives. It's going to be really, really, really negative. So when all of these rabbis in Europe read this from the Ribaz, they all said, wow, like America's much worse than we ever thought. And we're going to see a little bit later, all the way up until 1939, Rav Aaron Cutler is going to call immigration papers going to America, he calls them toilet paper. He tells the students, do not avail yourself. As Rav Chaim Uzer writes in the third volume of his Sefer called Achiezer, and he himself was influenced by this Ribaz, he writes this is already 1940, I think that's when it was published, the third volume of Achiezer, he actually writes, he says, better for us to be here and having this issue with our bodies versus going over to America and having issues with our souls, much better for us to perish here in Europe rather than go. And it was Rav Chaim Uzer ended up passing away in early 1941 and really ended up missing, because he passed away, he ended up missing really all of the bad stuff. We're actually going to discuss this because Rav Aaron Cutler is actually very, very important for this. So basically, the Ribaz was the rabbi of Slutsk. And he writes to the Alter Mislabadka. And he says, please, I want to start a yeshiva. Please send me guys to start the yeshiva. So I don't know if I was running a high-level yeshiva. I'd send my okay guys. I'd send maybe people that need a little bit more personal attention. But the Alter was a great tzaddik. He was amazing. So who did he send? He sent his 14 top students. Like, by far, his 14 top students. And these people, they were dubbed the Yad HaChazaka, which is Yad Dalet, the 14 people of tremendous strength. Just to give you an idea of who these people were, it was Rav Nassim Tzvi Finkel's own son, Rav Lazer Yudel Finkel, who would end up becoming the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir later. You have Rav Avraham Shmuel Levitz, who would end up being the father of Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, the famous Sichas Musar. You have Rav Pesach Prushkin, who would end up being Rav Moshe Feinstein's Rebbe, just to give you an idea. Really huge. You have Rav Meir Wachvogel, whose son would end up going to America and being involved with South Fallsburg. Before then, he actually went to YU, but most people don't know about that. Then you have Reuven Katz, who would end up being the chief rabbi of Petach Tikva. He had a big influence on Rav Avadia. Really, these are all Gedolei Olam. These are all people who are, famous far and wide. So these were the people that started the yeshiva of Slutsk. What happened was is that the Ribaz, he gets his job opportunity of going to America. He decides to take it. He leaves Europe. So who's going to take over? Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer decides to take over. And not only that, he actually takes over to be the chief rabbi of Slutsk. He's not just the Rosh Yeshiva. He's also the chief rabbi at the exact same time. That's going to be very important. So, he is basically running this yeshiva, this break-off, this thing called Slutsk. So he ends up getting Rav Aaron Cutler to move away from Slobodka and come learn with him in Slutsk. And what happened was is that he actually sees him, and according to all of the biographies, he sees this great tzaddik, this great son-in-law potential, and he says, I want you to be my son-in-law, and he ends up becoming his son-in-law, which is very cool. That's the way the story is told. However, I heard from another source a very fascinating story. Doesn't really get, it's just fascinating. What happened was there was a great rabbi, his name was Rav Moshe Aaron Peleyev. Rav Moshe Aaron Peleyev used to be the Rosh Yeshiva of YU, and he was actually learning in Slutsk at the time. And what happened was, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer goes to the Beit Midrash, and he says, oh, I need a shidduch for my daughter. And he's looking around for Rav Moshe Aaron Peleyev. So Rav Moshe Aaron Peleyev was actually gone. He went away for 3 weeks to his family, and while he was gone, he was read an amazing shidduch, and he ends up coming back engaged. So Rav Yisrael Meltzer says, oh my gosh, I can't believe it, Moshe Aaron, like, you left, you were going to be my son-in-law. So he says, I'm totally sorry, like, you know, I guess that's the breaks of the game. So what happens is that, this is the way that is told by the Peleah family, that what happened was, is that Rav Yisrael Zalman said, okay, I'll take the second best guy in yeshiva. And that was Rav Aaron Cutler. I mean, take that story for what it is, but it's really, really, it's really, really, really interesting. Now, Rav Aaron Cutler is not so, like, his life was not so pashut in terms of, like, a lot of these gedolim, like, it's like, oh wow, like, you know, they were born crazy geniuses, and they obviously, like, you know, they knew Torah from the first second that they came out of their mom's mouth. Rav Aaron was a crazy genius, but, like, he had a lot of influences that were basically pulling at him at the time. Haskalah was in full force, the Enlightenment, and there were many people that wanted to get this huge genius onto their side. So in fact, I mean, this is brought down in Making of a Gadol by Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's son. So he actually writes, he says that at a very young age, Rav Aaron actually learned, a lot of the Russian classics. He was familiar with them, but a lot of this stuff that, like, influenced him early about, like, getting this type of, you know, exposure actually turned him the total other direction. Like, him and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky both got that type of education early on in terms of knowing the Russian classics, but Rav Yaakov really didn't disavow it, but really Rav Aaron, as we're going to see, was very, very different. His last name was actually Pines, P-I-N-N-E-S. Actually, was searching for the name because his older sister, and this is also an amazing story, his older sister ended up becoming a math professor at Columbia. She ended up teaching math. Rabbi Zvulun Charlap, who was my Rosh Yeshiva at YU, used to go visit her in a nursing home in the Bronx. And she was supposedly very interesting, and she always, she told this to Rabbi Charlap, she always said, my brother could have been this huge math genius. Instead, he just became Rosh Yeshiva. What a waste. That's what she said, which is really interesting. I mean, so it's funny, I was looking online, and, like, you gotta search, so I'm looking, and, like, you have this one weird website from this family called the Cutlers, and they're talking about how awesome it is that Rav Aaron Cutler is related to them. So someone actually writes in and is like, no, Rav Aaron Cutler is not related to you, because his real last name was Pines, P-I-N-N-E-S. There's a whole discussion in terms of how he exactly got that name. Part of it is probably due to, like, army, communism, coming to America, visas, very interesting stuff. That's how a lot of this stuff happened. That's how you have, for example, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, his son's last name was Rabbinowitz. So, like, how did all that happen? In terms of, you just basically took a name. I have a good friend, his last name is Weissman. He was able to come to, his family was able to come to America because he actually took a dead Nazi's name, which is, like, crazy. And, like, last name is Weissman, and now his kids are, like, learning in Kolel, which is, like, out of this world. Yeah.
So was the dead Nazi's last name Weissman?
Yeah, yeah. So they were able to come to America.
How was it spelled?
W-E-I-S-S-M-A-N-N. Yeah, Weissman. Yeah, I know, it's crazy. I mean, he's a big study. He's actually teaching in Silver Spring now, if I'm not mistaken. So, so what happened was, is that Rav Aaron's older sister wanted to bring him over, you know, Star Wars is the big thing right now, wanted to bring him over to the dark side. So she used to write letters to Slobodka. She used to write letters. And what happened was, is that Rav Aaron, you know, he doesn't understand. His father had passed away, his mom had passed away, and he really had no one, no family. He was very close to his older sister. He was wondering, how come I'm not getting any letters from my older sister? It's very strange. So he's learning and learning and learning in Slobodka. So right as he's about to leave and go to Slutsk, the Alter Mis Slobodka brings him in, and the Alter Mis Slobodka pulls out a stack of letters, ginormous stack of letters. Every single letter was from his sister. And it was saying, I don't understand, Rav Aaron, how come you're not writing me back? But still, I'll tell you how my life is going. You got to become, you know, mathematician. You got to come over to this Haskalah side. It's so much better. So the Alter Mis Slobodka, he basically kept Rav Aaron safe from this influence. It's very, very, very interesting story. Very, very interesting. So Rav Aaron became more and more influential in the yeshiva, because what happened was that Slutsk, if you want to see, let's look at this again. I know this is small, I apologize. Volozhin is over here, Slutsk is over here, and Klesk is over here. So you see, very, very close to each other, Slutsk and Klesk, sorry, what am I farting this? Klesk, Kleszcz and Celeste were very, very, very close to each other, and that's on purpose. The reason why is because in 1917 the Russian Revolution came, and Celeste became a huge disaster. In fact, Rav Isser Zalman was arrested multiple times. So who took control of the yeshiva while he was in prison? His son-in-law, Rav Aaron, took charge, and he was really tremendous, really, really tremendous. And Rav Isser Zalman, while he was gone, he entrusted everything to Rav Aaron. In 1921, they decided, because of all of the Russian issues going on, they decided that Celeste Yeshiva should break into two, Celeste should break into Kleszcz, and Rav Aaron should take a whole bunch of Talmidim, half the Talmidim, and bring them over the Polish-Russian border, and therefore be able to have more autonomy. They'd be able, if you could see the page, I know it's not really so clear, I really apologize. But basically, they ended up breaking into two.
Where was Slobodka on this
one? So Slobodka, oh man, that's gonna be rough. I'll email it to you. I have a better copy than this one. I apologize. So yeah, I made this from the hospital room. So basically, I'm not even joking. So in 1921, they decided to split it. Rav Isser Zalman stayed in communist Russia. He tried the best he could. Eventually, that just totally became untenable. And in 1923, the yeshiva ended up basically becoming one yeshiva again in Kleszcz. In Kleszcz. 1 year later, Rav Isser Zalman makes Aliyah. 1 year later, Rav Isser Zalman makes Aliyah and decides to go to Eretz Yisrael. He becomes the head of the famous Eitz Chaim yeshiva. We'll talk about him in Eretz Yisrael because he was absolutely fascinating. So why exactly was there a split? So there's a lot of discussion about this. We're like, why did Rav Isser Zalman leave? Why did he leave? So a lot of this has to do from students that were around at the time. There's all stuff brought in Mekiv HaGadol. There's all stuff brought down in different zichronot from different rabbis and stuff. There was a bit of tension because Rav Isser Zalman was a very, very big moderate. He was an extremely moderate individual, extremely moderate. In fact, when Rav Kook was getting arrows and rocks, I mean proverbial arrows, real rocks, thrown at him in Eretz Yisrael, who was the one that came up and defended him? It was Rabbi Pesach Frank, and the second great Gadol was Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. In fact, when Rav Kook passed away in 1935, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, first of all, he gave a beautiful hesped, and he also said, there's no more Gedolim in the world, the last Gadol passed away, Rav Kook was the last Gadol, he's better than all of us. This is something that Rav Aaron Cutler never in a million years would have ever said. He never would have said this. What exactly is the reason behind this? Part of this is because Rav Isser Zalman came from a previous generation. Like, this always used to bother me when I was younger. It's like, wait, I don't get it. Rav Isser Zalman is so open and so, you know, and so, I don't know, so grandfatherly, and then Rav Aaron is so, like, you know, strong and scary and everything. Like, how exactly did that relationship work? So the answer is that there was tension, and that it didn't work exactly perfectly. I mean, Rav Isser Zalman was very, very proud of his own, very, very proud of his own son-in-law. In fact, in 1929, when they actually opened up a dorm and they opened up a new Beit Midrash in Kleszcz, Rav Isser Zalman actually came from Eretz Yisrael and came back to Europe to be part of the Chanukah Bayit, and then he actually went back and returned, you know, back to Eretz Yisrael. But, like, there was absolute tension. The reason why is because of the previous generation. The previous generation that had been around before Rav Aaron, they were significantly more moderate because even, like, those people that were, like, into Haskalah, they weren't necessarily the ones that were, like, so, you know, rah-rah, so, I'm going to use the word bad, even though I'm totally oversimplifying this. That, like, the previous generation wasn't nearly as, the term I'll use is lahafis. It was, like, more like l'teavon. It was more like that they were becoming Haskalah more because, like, they wanted to, like, lower the requirements of Judaism and stuff. But then, like, as time went on, it became significantly more ideological. So Rav Aaron was against this new generation very, very much, and therefore he felt like he had to be much stronger about a lot of different issues than Rav Isser Zalman. So there are three main examples. Example number one is that Rav Isser Zalman, when he was in Volozhin, he was part of a club. It was a secret club in Volozhin. It was called Nesiona. That's what the club was called. It was a secret Zionist club. And it had a whole bunch of members in it. Now, Volozhin at the time, there were many different times in history, but Volozhin at the time was a hotbed of communism, which is fascinating. You had a lot of people very into that. And also, but most especially, Zionism. Even though the Netziv was part of a group called the Chovevei Tzion, which means he did try to encourage Aliyah, and he tried encouraging a lot of Zionistic ideas. Nevertheless, he felt like that for his yeshiva, that shouldn't at all be, you know, that should not even come up in the slightest. In terms of our goal here in Village is to learn. If you want to be a Tzioni, if you want to be a Zionist, if you want to do this, do this. But basically, when we're here, we're absolutely learning. We're totally learning. So Rav Isser Zalman was part of this group, this surreptitious group of Zionists. A lot of these yeshivot actually had groups like this. So for example, in the Mir, there was a very secret invite-only group by a great rabbi named Rav Yerucham Levavitz. And what he did, Rav Yerucham, yeah, I think I'm right, but yeah, Rav Yerucham. So Rav Yerucham used to give a Thursday night shiur in Ramban Al HaTorah, invite-only, that to the people in the Mir at the time, they actually dubbed it, well, not exactly this, but they dubbed it Zionism 101. Basically, like, you know, starting Zionism. And a lot of people who actually went to those shiurim in 1936, especially, actually ended up making aliyah before the entire, you know, Churban Europa, before all of that stuff. So I'm saying it's not, like, necessarily so rare that yeshiva is going to have these groups of Zionists, you know, stuck within there. So Rav Isser Zalman, even though he was part of the Agudas Yisrael, was very, very pro the ideas of Zionism, at least. He was at least very open to it. Number two, Rav Isser Zalman, he, like we mentioned before, he became the rabbi of Slutsk. Many other types of Rosh Yeshiva, they don't want anything to do with the town. He said, no way, and he absolutely cared so much about the uneducated members of this, of the community, which was, you know, which is very rare for a great gadol. Like, the thing that they, in theory, should be concentrating on are their shiurim and yeshiva and how their students are doing and everything. But he cared very, very much about the common person just as much as he cared about people in yeshiva. In addition, Rav Isser Zalman also supported a slut school that taught Torah and secular studies in the same, you know, curriculum, which at that time is absolutely radical. But Rav Isser Zalman most certainly supported it. So we see over here three different things. As we'll see later on, when he goes, when he does make Aliyah, he is very, very much part of this group of Rav Yaakov Moshe Harlap, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, part of this group of people that are very, very, you know, pro-Zionist. And, like, you know, I don't want to say, I mean, it's hard to say, like, full pro-Zionist. I'll just tell a very small story. There was a great rabbi. His name was Rav Shmuel Rozovsky. Maybe through this story I'll tell. Rav Shmuel Rozovsky was the Rosh Yeshiva of a yeshiva called Panovich. And he unfortunately passed away in 1979 of cancer. He passed away very, very early. So he actually, he was able to get away from the Holocaust and everything. And he ended up going, he ended up becoming Rosh Yeshiva in Panovich in Bnei Brak. And what happened was, is that one time his students came to go visit him and they saw him listening to the radio. And what was he listening to? He was listening to a soccer game. And the soccer game was between Israel and the USSR. And the students, they couldn't believe it. These are students in Panovich Yeshiva, the Harvard, the MIT Yeshivot, and they're listening to the Rosh Yeshiva, listening to a soccer game? Like, can you imagine more of a Bitul Zman? I can't believe it. So they asked him, they said, Rebbe, why are you listening to this? Why? So he answered them. He said, if you would live what I lived through, if you would live during the war period, if you would live through this stuff, you would see why I'm listening to this. So once again, I'm not saying that, like, he agreed with every single Zionistic thing and, like, agreed with, like, you know, kibbutzim and agreed with a lot of, like, the mixed stuff that unfortunately went on and a lot of the anti-Sephardic stuff that went on. I'm not talking about that, but absolutely very much pro a from state, that would be something that would be very good, as opposed to, like, for example, as we're going to see, the Satmar Rav, as opposed to even Rav Aaron.
What year was this?
Oh, Rishon Rozovsky, that was 19... That, I don't know when the soccer game was, but he passed away in 1979. When we gave Shiurim a couple years ago, we gave on Rav Shach. So I don't know, I have this whole idea in my head. I don't know, I've never seen this written anywhere, but, like, basically Rishon Rozovsky passing away early, like, changed Haredi society, because Rav Shach ended up becoming the Rosh Yeshiva in 1979 of Panovich, and then ended up becoming, you know, the biggest political power player in the state of Israel by far until Rav Avadia comes in 1994. Yeah?
They used to say Eretz Yisrael.
It's true. It's
true.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And we're going to discuss this because, like, Rav Aaron has a very, very interesting relationship with Rav Soloveitchik, because Rav Soloveitchik originally was part of the Agudas Yisrael in the early 30s. Not early. In the mid 30s, he was part of the Agudas Yisrael, which, you know, I mean, a lot of people would probably disavow nowadays, but from both sides. But so let's give an idea about the machloket between Rav Isser Zalman and between his son-in-law Rav Aaron. There's a great rabbi. I mean, I shouldn't say so great, but basically, he was a very fascinating person. His name was Rabbi Moshe Shigier C-H-I-G-I-E-R. He actually wrote a Zichronot. I wish I could get them, but they're $75 on Amazon, and there's no way I'm paying $75 for a book like that on Amazon. Other books, you know, absolutely. But basically, he was a student who was learning in, he was learning in Kletsk. And what happened was, is that he falls in love with Eretz Yisrael, he falls in love with Rav Kook, and he tells Rav Aaron Cutler, he says, I want to go to Eretz Yisrael to go learn Torah Eretz Yisrael. I want to go there, I want to go learn by Rav Kook. Rav Aaron Cutler hears about this, and he says, get out of my yeshiva, you're out, I don't want you anymore, out. So Rav Isher Zalman hears about this, and he tells this person, Moshe, he says, you're kicked out of yeshiva, you have nowhere to go, come and live in my house, and don't worry, I'll take care of all of the visas for you, I'll take care of all of the money for you, I'll take care of everything. That's exactly what happened. So the point is that they were extremely, extremely, extremely different people. Rav Isher Zalman and Rav Aaron Cutler. Very, very, very different people, especially when it comes to the State of Israel. Very, very different. So during the 20s and 30s, during the 20s and 30s, that's already America, let's go back to this one. During the 20s and 30s, Rav Aaron Cutler becomes bigger and bigger. He becomes more involved in the Agudas Yisrael, becomes very involved. Part of this has to do because Poland at the time, they actually did view Agudas Yisrael as a political party. So for that reason, he was very involved in those types of politics. So many students want to come to his yeshiva. His yeshiva was known as a yeshiva that was very, very serious. A very, very serious yeshiva, which is a pretty big deal. There was a book that was just published last month. It's by a person named Rabbi Moshe Aaron Rieger. This is Rav Simcha Zalig Rieger's son-in-law. I mean, not son, Rav Simcha Zalig Rieger's son. It was just published. I forgot what it's called. I went through it in the night. It was tremendous, really tremendous. So he writes in there that, like, Kletsk was known as a yeshiva that was a very, very serious yeshiva, that Rav Aaron was known to be a very, very serious Rosh yeshiva, and that was something very important. Fantastic book, I highly suggest it. So Rav Aaron obviously has to raise money, so he runs, no, I shouldn't say runs, he goes to America. That's what people used to do back in the day. He goes to America, and in the mid-30s he actually gives all these shiurim. He gives shiurim in Torah Vedas, and this is where a big machlokes comes. He also, according to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, I'm not going to say he swore because he didn't swear, but he said, I remember in the mid-30s Rav Aaron Cutler came to Yeshiva University and he gave a shiur in the Beis Medrash at Yeshiva University. Most biographies will say that's absolutely not true, and Rav Aaron refused to step foot into YU. In fact, there was, man, this is just coming to me now, there was a great rabbi, oh man, I can't believe I'm blanking on his name, this is really bad, he went with the Lumzerov. Oh, yes. So, oh, thank you so much. Oh, my. I have a picture of him up in my classroom. Oh, my. Now I can sleep tonight. Oh, man. On the hospital floor. Ramosha Shaskis. When it was his funeral, he passed away, and they had his Aaron in Lamport Auditorium in YU. So Rav Aaron Cutler came, and also Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky came, because they were all members of this group of amazing people in Slobodka. In fact, they said that Ramosha Shaskis, they said that he was the top student of the Altami Slobodka. So they were coming, and Rav Yaakov wanted to go into YU to hear all of the Hespedim in Lamport Auditorium, and Rav Aaron just stood. He would not go into the building until Rav Yaakov dragged him. Rav Yaakov was like, come on, give me a break, what are you doing? And he dragged him in, but Rav Aaron did not want to step foot in YU. So you can see why there's a big machlokas. There's also something else I want to say for the end, but it actually works out very well here, that one time on his deathbed, on Rav Aaron, this just shows you, this is in a book by a former, I don't know, he was part of the Knesset in Israel. He wrote like a sefer called Bimchisasam, and he wrote this entire thing, and so he said that on Aaron's deathbed, someone was talking about Yeshiva University, and someone mentioned Yeshiva University, and Rav Aaron, on his deathbed, you know, with very, very weak, he told the person, don't refer to that place as a yeshiva. That's what he said. Now, I don't know if that story is true. I mean, we're going to get into, I mean, he most certainly was not a fan of Yeshiva University. But then again, he also was not a fan of Rav Chaim Berlin, and he was not a fan of Torah Vedas. He was not a fan of the classic yeshivot because of their involvement with secular studies. He was very, very against that. So that's like a huge, huge fight. World War II happened, and Lithuania was overrun in 39 and 40. And Rav Aaron Cutler was adamant to stay in Europe. He was absolutely adamant to stay in Europe. He says, I'm not leaving my Talmidim. And when he had been in America in the mid-30s, he was very much not impressed with America, not impressed with anybody at all. To quote, there's a great story that when Rav Soloveitchik ended up coming in 1936, he gave a shiur to the top rabbis in America, and Rav Lazar Silver was there, and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, his father, said, "Don't worry about any of these rabbis here. They're not going to schlug up. They're not going to mess up your shiur, because they haven't picked up a sefer in years. The only person you have to worry about is Rav Lazar Silver. That's the only person you have to worry about." So just to give you an idea of what America was like at the time, it was not a particularly great bastion of learning. So Ram Kalir was adamant about staying in Europe at the time, and they end up going, like all the other yeshivot, they end up going to Vilna and being with Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski, who was being in charge of the entire like yeshiva war effort. In fact, when they were in Vilna, Rav Aaron hated it so much that he couldn't stay in Vilna. Like they all, like the yeshiva, the entire yeshiva of Klesk came to Vilna, but he was very much against being in the city center. He was so against it, so he actually moved his yeshiva out of Vilna to a few miles away so he could, you know, have influence over them. And what happened was, is that Rav Aaron was one of the last people to get out of Europe. He actually ends up going through Japan, and through Japan ends up going to San Francisco. A week later, he ends up in New York. He ends up getting an apartment first, this is what I've heard, first in Washington Heights. Later on, he ends up getting an apartment in the Upper West Side. Then after that, he ends up getting an apartment in Brooklyn. And Rav Aaron Cutler comes to America. And the first thing he starts doing is start working on getting Jews out of the Holocaust, And this is something, it's pretty crazy. In terms of when he first came, he was very, very much into saving the Jewish people. Very, very much. So the most famous, there's two very, very famous stories. If you go to Source 8 and Source 9, wow, I can't believe it, wow. And time is going by quickly. So if you look at Source 8, I'll read it. It's a great story. I'm sure a lot of you guys have heard it. It's really amazing, really tremendous. This seemingly too incredible to be true story actually took place. It was during World War II when 24 Rabbonim were being held in Italy and faced being returned to Nazi-occupied Europe and certain death. Rav Aaron Cutler, founder and Rosh Yeshiva of the Lakewood Yeshiva, turned to the well-known Askin and subsequent author of Ethics from Sinai, Irving Bunim, and asked him who could intercede on behalf of these 24 Rabbanim. Irving Bunim suggested the Italian Mafia. Rav Cutler urged Mr. Bunim to contact them immediately. After contacting them, he asked Rav Aaron, "Who are we sending to the meeting?" Rav Aaron replied, "You and I are going." Off they went to meet the godfather of the mafia, Joe Bonanno. Rav Aaron did not speak English, so it was Mr. Bunim who explained the problem of the 24 Rabbanim trapped in Italy. The mafia chief asked Mr. Bunim, "Who is the elderly man sitting next to you?" He told him, "He's the godfather of the Jewish people." "Really?" asked the mafia chief. "Yes," replied Mr. Bunim emphatically. "Tell him I want a blessing." So Mr. Irving Bunim turned to Rav Aaron and in Yiddish told him, I'll read the English, sorry, "He wants a blessing from the Rav." So, okay, I'm not going to read that next part. Irving Bunim turned back to the mafia chief, Joe Bonanno, and told him, "The rabbi blesses you with a long life, and you should die in bed." Upon hearing this, the mafia chief replied, "I like that," and promised within 2 weeks to arrange the freedom of the 24 Rabbanim stuck in Italy, which he did indeed accomplish. 20-something years later, in 1964, a shiny black stretch limo pulls up in front of Lakewood Yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey. Two fancy-dressed men get out and walk up to the office. They say they are looking for Rabbi Cutler. Out comes a man who introduces himself. "No, not you," say the two Italian guys. "We're looking for an older man." "That was my father," says Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Shneur Cutler, "but he passed away a number of years ago." The Italian man explained that they are the Bonanno brothers, and that their father always attributed his long life to your saintly father's blessing. "Now that he has just retired, we are taking over the business, and we came here for the same blessing." I'm sorry," said Rav Shneur. "My father could do that, but I am not on that high level." Disappointed, but clearly understanding the concept of Yerida Sadoros, the descent of the generations, the new mafia chiefs bid farewell to Rav Shneur. For saving 24 Rabbanim from the Nazis, and with their own Cutler's bracha, Joe Bonanno, the mafia godfather, lived to 97 years old. So that's one story, which is amazing, really amazing.
I don't think they would walk away so easily without the blessing.
Yeah, maybe Rav Shneur gave a blessing. I don't know. But maybe he gave the caveat that it wouldn't be not that effective. So number nine. In what would have been the most important? This is this is the most famous Rav Aharon Cutler story about the war. There's one other one that I'll add that I did not get a chance to put in the Mar Makomos. And what would have been the most important rescue effort of the war? Known as the Musi negotiations, 600,000 Jews would have been freed by the Nazis in exchange for $1 million. Rav Cutler's Vod had no way to raise such an amount and turned to the Joint Distribution Committee. The Joint would have nothing to do with a plan involving trading with the enemy, which was a gross violation of federal law. Nonetheless, they agreed to a meeting. An arrangement was finally worked out whereby the Joint would agree to forward the money provided the Vod acquire a license from the U.S. government, allowing the Vod to transfer money to Switzerland, whence it would be delivered into Nazi hands. A Vod delegation led by Rabbi Cutler set off to Washington, but an audience with the president was not forthcoming. The rabbi's group was referred to the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau Jr., a Jew. His Jewishness did not help their cause. What the committee was seeking was way out of his league, and he flatly refused. Rabbi Cutler turned to his translator and told him to relay the following message. Tell him that if he cannot help rescue his fellow Jews at this time, then he is worth nothing, and his job is worth nothing, because one Jewish life is worth more than all the positions in Washington. The translator, who happened to be Irving Bunim, hesitated, and then said something which vaguely resembled what the rabbi had said. Rabbi Cutler, seeing Morgenthau's relaxed look, sensed that his message was not properly conveyed. The rabbi turned to the translator and instructed him to relay the exact message, word for word, which he did. Morgenthau's composure sank as he faced the rabbi's famous fury stare. An awkward silence filled the room, and the secretary placed his head down on his desk for what seemed like an eternity. He then sat up and told the translator to translate. Tell the rabbi that I'm a Jew, and that I'm willing to give up my life, not only my position, for my people. The deal eventually fell through, but the determination and grit of Rabbi Cutler had made its impact and left us with incredible and unbelievable legacy. Another story to tell about Rav Aharon is that many people were very upset that Rav Aharon worked with the head of the JDC, which was Stephen J. Wise, who was a Reform rabbi, and they asked Rav Aharon, you know, you're so against all of these different types of secular people. Why are you working with Dr. Wise? So his answer was, I would work with the Pope if it meant saving a Jewish person. That's what it really means to me. There's another very famous story. I'm forgetting exactly who the Rav was. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it might be Rabbi Chesed Abramsky. I'm not sure. But basically, if anyone could tell me, I was looking for this online. I couldn't find it. But basically, there was a Friday night. Irving Bunim tells the story. There's a great biography, really, really great biography by Amos Bunim, who I had the zechut of knowing, you know, years ago. He actually passed away. He was a great, great tzaddik. I actually stayed by his daughter-in-law's house, his daughter's house in Muncie. So Irving Bunim, he was tremendous. Like a lot of people say, I've heard this before, that like no one would have known about Irving Bunim if not for Rav Aharon Cutler. I mean, Rabbi Harlap one time told me, he said he thinks it's the total opposite, that you would not know about Rav Aharon Cutler if it wasn't for Irving Bunim, which we'll discuss in a little bit, So basically, in this book, it tells a crazy story. It says that on a Friday night, there was an issue about raising money to go get a Jewish person out from near death. And what happened was, is that, you know, all the Rabbanim, they're all like, what should we do? So Rav Aharon said, we're going to drive from house to house on a Friday night. Irving Bunim was actually the person who was the driver. And they went from house to house collecting money for this person and doing the mitzvah Pidyon Shvuyim, which is absolutely, you know, absolutely warranted. In 1942, a small group of refugees, these were people who were living in White Plains, New York, they asked Rav Aharon to teach them. They asked him to be a Rosh Yeshiva. And he accepted only under three conditions. Number one, cannot be in New York. Number two, Rav Aharon Cutler would only come on weekends. That would be it. And number three, he was the sole authority for any sort of matter that would come up, for all hashkafic matters, and for all policy matters. He would be the one in charge. So BMG, Beis Medrash Gavoa, opened. You could actually see a picture of their first building over here. Very, very small. And opened, believe it or not, with 14 students in Lakewood Yeshiva. This was in 1942. Why? Oh, we're going to get to that. So there's a classic answer, which we'll discuss, and there's an answer that I know, I wish I could put this on pause. I think I could put this on pause. Sure. Is there a way to put this on pause? Yeah. So Rav Aharon Cutler, he supported Agudas Yisrael, and he very much opposed Zionism, opposed socialism, he opposed the Haskalah, and he refused to work with non-Orthodox members. This became a big, big issue later on. In the 1950s, early 1950s, he had a huge machloket with his friend, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Rav. They had a big issue about being a member of the synagogue council, which we'll discuss in a little bit, which is a bigger issue, which really goes back. We've actually discussed this when we spoke about when we spoke about Sarah Schneerer, when we discussed the two different ways that a person could be, something called Austrit, which was the way that Rav Hirsch said to be, which means separate yourself. And we spoke about Rav Wolf Bamberger, who at the time was the Gadol Shel Yisrael, which at the time people couldn't believe that Rav Hirsch was disagreeing with Rav Wolf Bamberger. Rav Wolf Bamberger did not believe you should separate yourself. He believed that Jews should basically be, you know, kapei chutz. What that means is towards the world, they should be united, but internally they should have nothing to do with each other. Which we'll get to, So Lakewood was very isolationist, and way more than Torah Vadas, way more than Chaim Berlin, and way more than YU. Now the difference between Lakewood and Klesk, the difference between them is that Klesk was a town of 4,000 people, 3/4 of them were Jewish. The majority did not identify with Aaron Cutler. They didn't identify with Agudas Yisrael. In fact, they were very much Zionist. But the issue is that the students really did have contact with the community. There's something called, and you guys could correct me, because there's something called Essentag, which every single day a student would basically, you know, eat at the table of the person. And they didn't have dorms in Klesk. They did not. So they lived with amongst the people. They lived with them. And they lived with people that were ideologically different than them. And it was... The reason why is because dorms, it would be prohibitively expensive for Klecks to open up their own dorms. The first time that really ever happened was by Chachmei Lublin. Now Chachmei Lublin, they ended up, you know, making this beautiful, gorgeous building. I think it opened in 29 or 33, I don't remember the date. I do know that the marble that they use is the exact same marble that you could actually see that was built in 1929 in YU. When you first walk in, the marble comes from the exact same source, which is interesting. So basically, the town yeshiva got along. Some of them married. In fact, there's some stories by Klecks Talmidim that they wrote that if they were really adventurous, they would hang out with the girls, the local girls in town, which was like very, you know, Rav Aaron did not like that at all, but you know, unrequited love. So basically, the community, they depended on the yeshiva for housing, in terms of they were making money from housing, and they were making money from providing food for the yeshiva bachrim. They were providing food for everything that was going on in the community, so they found it to be beneficial. Also, they loved the fact that they could go around and say, well, we house the Klecks yeshiva where we live, and that's really tremendous, and that's really good. In 1929, they built their own building, which was downtown Klecks, downtown, and the yeshiva paid the townspeople, so the townspeople loved it. But Rav Aaron, you know, he was dealing with the situation at the time. People were traditional, and in other areas, in other places, the yeshiva and the town really didn't necessarily get along, but here they did get along, which was very, very special. But Lakewood could be isolated significantly better than Klesk. Why? So this goes back to New York. So New York is an hour and 50 minutes away. So it's far away enough that you're not being influenced by the bright lights of the city, you're not being influenced by the people there, but it's also close enough that you will be able to attract people, and that's also very, very important. So, what Rav Aaron was mainly worried about in New York, it wasn't so much the non-Jewish culture at all, he was mainly afraid of the Reform, the conservative, and also the modern Orthodox culture. Very, very much so. So much so that, as we mentioned before, Lakewood was a resort town. People used to go to Lakewood, they used to go from the city, that's why a whole bunch of hotels were there. Oh yeah, I mean there is a lake there, I've been there, I could attest to it, even though nowadays Lakewood just keeps on going on. I mean there, it's crazy, yeah, everyone wanted to get out of the city, so they used to have great rabbis come down and give shiurim there. So they used to have Rav Soloveitchik come down. Rav Soloveitchik, he was a speaker par excellence in terms of, when Chaim Moser passed away in 41, who did they ask to speak about him? They asked Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik's wife, Dr. Tanya, she was actually cousins with Rav Chaim Moser. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik actually described that going over to Rav Chaim Moser's house on Mosei Shabbos, they actually used to do Borei Morei Esh by the light of an electric bulb, because Rav Chaim Moser wanted to show that electricity is fire. So therefore, he specifically, during Havdalah time, specifically used the light bulb to show everybody what the halakha is, which is fascinating. So, what happened, I actually heard this story from Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld. who was very close to Aaron Cutler based on their work for Chinuch Atzmai and also Vada Sal even earlier. So Rabbi Schoenfeld, he told this amazing story. That what happened was is that Rav Soloveitchik used to come down to Lakewood and he used to give these beautiful shiurim, totally packed, standing room only. Everyone used to come. People who were not so religious and also the yeshiva bachram. Everyone used to come. Oh my, can you even imagine? It's incredible. So what happened was, is that one year, the students don't come. In terms of the Lakewood guys just aren't there. And Rabbi Schoenfeld, he had a close enough relationship with Rav Aaron. They approached Rav Aaron and he said, Rav Aaron, like, I don't get it. Like, you're yeshiva guys, you guys love Rav Soloveitchik and, you know, it's been great. And like, why this year are things different? So Rav Aaron Cutler answered. He said, the Rav is amazing, but he said, I can't let the Talmidim see that someone could go to secular college and still be a great gadol. So it's much easier for me to go ahead and isolate. And he was very, very much into this. And that's really where there was a big break. Now, what's interesting also is that during the summers, Lakewood used to be mechazik themselves. In fact, if you tell this to a Lakewood person nowadays, they'd probably laugh at you. But Rabbi Moshe Tendler actually was the person who actually organized this, is that they actually used to send down a contingent of YU guys for the summer to go learn in Lakewood Yeshiva to strengthen Lakewood Yeshiva, which, like, is crazy. So what happened was, Rav Schechter, he was at a very young age, he was like 13, 14 years old, and he used to go down there. A lot of other, Rabbi Rakefet, for example, used to go down to Lakewood, and used to learn there, and used to listen to Yeshiva of Rav Aaron Cutler. So Rav Schechter tells a humorous story that, like, some of the other Lakewood guys, they wanted to, like, bring over, you know, these guys to Lakewood. So they started, like, speaking disparagingly, yeah, about Rav Soloveitchik. So they referred to him as JB. JB. They're like, oh my, you know, I can't, you gotta leave JB, you gotta come here. So Rav Schechter said they didn't like it when we started referring to their rabbi as AK. They did not like that. You know, it's one of these things that you really have to be there for. So Lakewood was a very popular. So getting back to the classical reason as to why Lakewood is in Lakewood is because Rav Aaron wanted it to be far enough away from New York influence, number one. And number two, it was a vacation destination, which means it would be a great place to go ahead and raise money for the yeshiva. A lot of wealthy people fleeing the city, they want to come. Let's take the money from them, but let's not ideologically be a part of them. That seems to be a great idea. There's another idea, and this is something that I'm just throwing this out there. This is not written anywhere. This is like, this is very much Torah Shabbat Peh. The only time I ever told this story before was on Shavuos night, because I knew I wasn't being recorded. But, you know, whatever. We'll see. Okay, so basically, the story goes like this, is that Rav Aaron, as we mentioned before, Rav Aaron was very, very much, he did not believe that the Nazis were actually going to go and actually destroy Lithuania. He didn't believe any of that stuff was going to happen. And many students approached him. Many students approached him and they said, we can leave, we have this opportunity. And he told them specifically, do not leave. The Torah will protect you. Do not leave in the slightest. Whatever you do, please don't leave. So what happened was, most Talmidim did not leave. And actually, if you look at all the history books, and this every history book says that the Talmidim in Klecks, almost all of them passed away. And Rav Aaron was able to get out. So when Rav Aaron first came to New York, this is the way the story is told, when he first came to New York, he was living on 92nd Street. First he was living in Russian Heights, then he was living on 92nd Street. And what happened was that he used to run into former Talmidim. So run into former Talmidim of his, and in fact, you know, there was this one person who actually ended up going to Tells, who actually ended up publishing all Sefer as a scum about Rav Soloveitchik. And this person, his brothers had gone to Klecks. He had also gone to Klecks, but he disagreed with Rav Aaron, and he actually fled to America, and his two older brothers got killed by the Nazis. And he was very, very, very upset. Very, very upset at Rav Aaron, because, I mean, they had the opportunity of leaving, and, you know, and they didn't leave. So what happened was that Irving Bunim is really the person, he's really the hero in this story. That Irving Bunim, this is also told about Irving Bunim, that Irving Bunim, he held Zev Jabotinsky, he was holding him as Zev Jabotinsky died. that like he was upstate New York. He was part of one of these Zionist groups, and Zev Jabotinsky, he was very much a Jabotinskyist, very much so. So he also became very, very, very inspired by Rav Aaron. And when someone asked him, someone said, "I don't get it. Like, could you think of two people so diametrically opposed? You have, you know, Zev Jabotinsky on the one hand and Rav Aaron Cutler on the other hand." He answered, he said, "I'm after MS, I'm after truth, that's what I'm after. So it doesn't matter where the source comes from, I'm very much into truth." So Irving Bunim saw the situation. Rav Aaron was constantly reminded up in New York. He was constantly reminded of these Talmidim and of all of these former Talmidim that passed away, and he was very, very depressed. So in order to get Rav Aaron out of the city, Irving Bunim selected Lakewood, New Jersey. This is a story that I've been told. Once again, take it or leave it. And therefore, he said, in order to get him out of the city, in order to get him from seeing all these people and really to revitalize him, let's have him go ahead and start a yeshiva. And what they actually did, it actually ended up changing Rav Aaron tremendously. It really helped him so much, and his whole personality changed, and that's really when he ended up really diving into the Hatzalah work for the stuff going on in Europe, and also Lakewood Yeshiva. Just a small thing about Lakewood Yeshiva. So I'll do this. This one. Right. So in Europe, So basically, Lakewood was a Gentile town. Very much unlike Kletsk, which was 3/4 Jewish. Lakewood was a totally, totally Gentile town. And that was great. That was awesome. Why was that so good? Because you could be totally isolationist. You could be totally by yourself. And the big thing that Rav Aaron came up with was dorms. If you have students in dorms, you can totally monitor what they're reading. You can monitor who they're hanging out with. You can monitor their comings and goings. The dorm was the big thing that really changed a ton. Not only that, Rav Aaron needed money. Oh, one more thing also. He also was very into stipends. He said, "I will go ahead and I will raise money for you to sit and learn Torah." For a lot of these, you know, students who, you know, they were living at home, for example, up in New York, and they had gone to yeshivot, and their parents expected them to go to either Torah Vadas, their parents expected them to go to Chaim Berlin, their parents expected them either to go to YU, eventually, you know, get a college education. They were supposed to go ahead and do that, and then, you know, then they go ahead off into the world and work. This became a very, very attractive thing for the students, because here, Rav Aaron's providing the money, I'm getting to learn Torah full time, and there's a dorm over here, and he's even providing stipends for married students, which is a pretty big deal also. So where exactly is all of this money coming from? Where's all of this money coming from? So what's interesting is that a lot of this money comes from people that were very much opposed to Aaron's worldview. Like, a lot of this came from like this group of people that were like, they were Orthodox non-practicing. What do I mean by that? That, like, they would never have gone to like a conservative reform synagogue. They never in a million years would have done that. Like, the greatest, my favorite case of this is Supreme Court Justice Cardozo. Now, what happened was that in the early 20s, they wanted to turn Sherith Israel, the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, they wanted to turn it into a mixed seating synagogue, which was the whole rage at the time. And Judge Cardozo came and he said, "No way." He said, "I want to go to a synagogue that my great-grandparents, even though I myself am not religious, but I'm not going to, you know, endorse going to a synagogue that my great-grandparents would not go to. That's something that I would never do." So after the Holocaust, after, you know, 45, after the Holocaust, there was a lot of nostalgia from a lot of these Jews, that even though they themselves were not religious, to see someone like Rav Aaron, who's bearded and a real Rosh Yeshiva, who has this dream of transplanting a real kollel, a real learning environment with nothing else mixed in, that was something that was extremely, extremely, extremely attractive. That was something to give money to. It was awesome. Like, we'll go ahead and we'll give money to this cause. And it's crazy because the fundraising helped. You might think that if you compromise, therefore you're going to be able to go ahead and get more people to give you money. It was actually quite the opposite. Because he did not compromise, he actually got more money. There's all these stories about Rav Aaron berating people and telling them, you're giving me money. Stop working. Don't even do this. No way. Your life is a waste because you're not learning Torah, because you're not learning Torah, which is absolutely fascinating. Like, he would tell this to people to their face, and they would go ahead and write him these ginormous checks, which is really nice. So the round color was able to develop a social and intellectual isolation with economic self-sufficiency. And he was very much into Torah only. So Lakewood is able to attract students, but it was extremely different than Kleck's. Because by Kleck's, they were not educated, but they were traditional. So since they weren't educated, and they were more traditional, they actually presented more of a danger. Because here, who are these students that are coming? These are students that already have a high school education. These are students who are willingly rejecting the ways of their parents. And those types of students are much, much easier to co-opt into your yeshiva. They rejected Zionism, but it was a place of intense learning. This extreme vision, which, you know, since World War II, is really dominated. And in fact, this over here, this is a picture of one of the Batei Midrasha. This is one of the study halls in Lakewood. Only one of them. I mean, there's. It's really amazing. I always say that if I was a teacher in I'm a teacher in Hillel Day School here. If I was a teacher in New York, I would absolutely every single year go on a pilgrimage just to see Lakewood, just to see it. We'll discuss in a little bit, you know, exactly what Lakewood is today versus what Rav Aaron really intended. So ironically, it was the secular nature of American culture that led to BMG's success. That's really what allowed it, because this type of isolationism, I gave you sources which we're not going to go through, because in all honesty, I'm exhausted. But we're going to, sorry about that, all this baby stuff. But basically, take a look at the sources. Over and over again, Rav Aaron's theme is that those people that are learning, those are the people that are the most important. Everything else is tafel, everything else is secondary. Those people that are learning are more loved by Hashem. They exercise more power, you know, by Hashem. And a lot of this idea, a lot of these ideas were stuff that really inspired the students to work harder and harder in yeshiva, because if they themselves are viewing themselves as this elite group of people, that's like really, really, really nice, especially the self-selected group of people, you know, they're going to work significantly harder. So Rav Aaron Cutler, as we mentioned before, he really did not spend a lot of time in Lakewood. According to people that were there, I spoke to many, 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 you know, older people that were in Lakewood, and they told me that he used to come on Friday afternoon, and he would come, he would stay for Shabbos, give a shiur on Shabbos morning, he would give a shiur on Sunday morning, and then go back up to New York, because he was so busy fundraising, he was so busy raising money for Chinuch Atzmi, Chinuch Atzmai, raising money for that, and raising money earlier for Vada Atzala. So he really did not spend so much time in Lakewood. There's a great story that he actually contacted the Chazon Ish, and he contacted the Chazon Ish, who we actually had a whole class about, and he asked, he said, I want you to send me a posek, because I'm not going to be around in Lakewood very often, so we need someone who will be a halachic decisor. And the Chazon Ish actually sent Rabbi Yitzchak Abadi, who's a big rabbi who currently still lives in Lakewood, very, very controversial rabbi. This is his Shalom to Shivot, Volume 1. He has two volumes of it called Or Yitzchak. He is a very, very controversial individual. Rav Aaron Cutler also raised students that were very controversial. Another student of his is another person, great rabbi who lives in Brooklyn. His name is Rabbi Jose Faur. Rabbi Jose Faur learned in Lakewood years and years ago. In fact, we actually spoke about him last week, if you guys remember, because Rabbi Matlub Abadi, who is not related to Rav Yitzchak Abadi, wrote a letter of defense because Rabbi Dr. Jose Faur taught at JTS, which at the time, you know, which even, whatever, which was very, very controversial. So he was also a famous halachic figure. And, you know, this is basically like, we're finishing basically. He was a very famous halachic figure. Very, very famous halachic figure. In fact, I was just recently reading a transcript of Rav Ovadia's son, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, just from this past week. And he was lamenting the fact that there are no great Lithuanian, no great Ashkenazi Rosh Yeshiva heads of schools that are also poskim. And one person that he said is someone that was Rosh Yeshiva and Posek was Rav Aaron Cutler. So what are some of his very, very famous psakim? What are some of his famous rulings? So number one is that he was very against joining the Synagogue Council of America. It was a group of rabbis. It was, you know, the New York Board of Rabbis. It's a whole thing where basically Orthodox, Reform, and conservative rabbis all were part of this rabbinical group together. Rav Soloveitchik believed that it was a better idea to really unite and stay together because he felt like that it would be able to exercise significantly more, it would be able to wield more power internationally if they were all together. Rav Aaron Cutler was totally against it. He said, you will not work with anyone who's Reform or conservative. That was something they was very much against. Number two, in Chelik Beis, there's a whole two volumes of something called Mishnas Rabbi Aaron, which are collected writings of Rav Aaron Cutler. So there's two volumes of Shelot to Tshuvot of Responsa. So in Chelik Beis, there's three Tshuvot back to back. Each one is about 15 pages. And these Tshuvot have to do with gelatin. Back in the day, Rav Chaim Ozer Gazensky, he writes in Achiezer, he thinks that gelatin, along with Sephardi Poskim, he thinks that gelatin is 100% okay. It doesn't matter what source it comes from. It doesn't matter if it's from pigs. It doesn't matter if it's from horses. The reason why is because of the fact that it undergoes such a major change. Rav Ovadia Poskim's 100% this way. Like, I was always told as a kid that, like, you know, oh, you know, Yosef, you could go ahead and have Skittles. I never, ever had Skittles. You know, I'm always scared. You know, never wanted to. But like, but the point is that like gelatin, according to Sephardim, is 100% okay. Rav Aaron Cutler proves through a halachic thing based on the Rush. The Rush writes about a halachic concept called achshavei, which means if you actually want it, then it does become something that's chashuv, that you really want to have. And therefore, it does become usher. And therefore, that's really how people have poskined in America, most certainly, like Rav Aaron Cutler. He's like the real reason why. And a lot of this has to do with his student. He had a student named Rav Shimon Eider. My brother-in-law is actually related, so they actually refer to him as Uncle Shimmy, which is like hilarious, because like he was this great rabbi. He actually learned in YU before going to Lakewood. He actually had a sign on his door. I heard this from the family. He had a sign on his door. He was a wrestler in YU. He had a sign on his door. He said, if you're going to speak Lashon Hara to me, I'm going to wrestle you to the floor. He had a sign on his door, which is, he was a great tzaddik. So he actually was the person who started really like pushing this issue based on Rav Aaron Cutler, and he was the one that started making this fish gelatin that nowadays, you know, especially around Pesach time, that we're all very, very thankful for. Number three, Lakewood Yeshiva was not Chalav Yisrael. Lakewood Yeshiva, even though there's been a lot of writing about this, some people say yes it was, some people say it wasn't. I've been told from people that were there that they said it was straight up not Chalav Yisrael. It wasn't. But once again, that might, a lot of that might have to do with the time period, because it was very, very difficult to get Chalav Yisrael. What's interesting is that it goes, you know, it's very interesting because it kind of goes against a Rav Moshe Feinstein that says that for yeshivot you should really expend more money and really really work hard to try to get Chalav Yisrael. But, you know, once again, a lot of this has to do with the times. So Chalav Yisrael. Number four, this is my favorite one. I quote this one all the time. Tuna. Rav Aaron Cutler ate bumblebee tuna without a hechsher. Without a hechsher, before it even had a kosher sign on it. What is the significance of that?
The times were different back then.
Ooh.
Also.
Ooh. About.
Well, in general, I mean, people were, like, maybe in the 60s and stuff, there were a lot of people going by ingredients.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So Rabbi Abadi, that's why he's so famous. Because Rabbi Abadi is one of these people who actually still adheres to this, where he says, like, you know, if you look at the ingredients and you see that, you know, you could basically ascertain it's less than 1/60, it's okay. But then you run into those issues of achshavei. It's very, very complicated. Very, very complicated. But a lot of the fish issue, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Hinkin, they all said that tuna fish is not kosher. Tuna fish is not kosher unless a mashkiach, a Jewish person themselves, checked the fish themselves. What does it have to do with? And most people have never even heard of this, because you go to every single Shal Shadis and you take a look on the table and you see bumblebee tuna, you know, whatever it is. You don't see even like the Haimasha Hachsherim. Even those, like, you know, Hachsherim, supposedly from what I've heard, aside from the Star K, even though it's not so Haimish, but aside from the Star K, even the Haimish Hachsherim rely on this Rav Aaron Cutler. What exactly is the issue? The issue is that Bidikat Simanim, taking a look at whether or not an animal is kosher, is a Deoraita. Happens to be a mitzvah from the Torah. So the question is, can you therefore delegate to a non-Jewish person to decide whether or not something has those Jewish signs, has those kosher signs or not?
What about the equipment?
equipment's not an issue, because, I mean, we're dealing with... I mean, there's nothing, like, bad about it. You know what I mean? No, not these places. I've seen videos. I'm telling you, it's really amazing. If you go to YouTube, yeah, but mistakes were not so even. Yeah, I hear that. But like the big issue, I mean, this is the big issue with tuna. The big issue with tuna is, can we rely on a non-Jewish person to? Because everyone. It's funny, a lot of people that you speak to are like, oh, it's the Bishul Yisrael problem. The problem is that it's cooked in these cans, it gets put into one of these heaters, and it's cooked, it's like this flash cooking, and maybe that counts as Bishul Akum, and maybe that's not good. So the question is, do we eat fish raw? It's fascinating stuff. But, getting back to this issue, if a non-Jew checks the kosher signs for you, that's not good enough. That is not good enough at all. A non-Jewish person could only check the signs for you if it's a Darabanan case. Only if it's a Darabanan. So for example, the famous case that everyone brings down, let's say for example I have a pot of soup and of chicken soup and a little piece of milk falls into the soup. A non-Jewish chef, a kfela, could go ahead and taste it, and if he could tell you that a piece of milk is tasteable in there, I just made up that word, that you can taste it in there, if you can actually ascertain that it's in there, it's not kosher. But if the kfela, if this non-Jewish person says that he can't taste it, then therefore it is totally kosher. And this has been, you know, extended to the 160th thing. But can we rely on non-Jews for checking the simanim and for checking it? What would be the reasoning to be makil? The reason why is because, this is something Rosh Hashanah wrote a beautiful article about this, which originally showed up in a YU journal, which ended up being published in a sefer called Ginat Egos, where he ends up showing that the three types of fish that they use, so one of them is called, you know, slipjack, or I'm forgetting exactly what they're called, but these three, first of all, you could only cook them with each other, and what I mean is that you could only cook one kind with one kind, one kind with one kind, one kind with one kind. If you end up introducing another type of fish in there, it will ruin the entire batch. So therefore, all they're doing is that they're not necessarily checking the sign, but you know for a fact that what is in there is kosher. Many, many Gedolim totally disagreed with it. In fact, I heard from a great rabbi, his name is Rabbi J. David Bleich. He told me that the food at Torah Vadas was terrible. Terrible. So a very enterprising Jewish person made a food cart and he parked their ass at the Torah Vadas. So someone asked Rav Yaakov, he said, what are we able to eat in there? So Rav Yaakov said, you could eat the salmon, because the salmon you could tell is a kosher fish by the pink in it, even though nowadays Rebelski has a whole article about this, because nowadays the red is now added, you know, artificially, whatever, it's a whole different story. Yeah, it's very interesting. I love this kind of stuff. But basically, so Rav Yaakov said, but do not touch the tuna fish, because the tuna fish it's not quote-unquote kosher. We basically rely on Rav Soloveitchik about this. We very much rely on Rav Aaron Cutler on this, where a lot of people, you know, eat, you know, if it has a regular OU on it, then it's totally, you know, that's according to Rav Aaron Cutler, it's according to Rav Soloveitchik. However, if it says OU Pesach, for example, that had a mashgiach that looked at every single point of the process and actually chose what went in and what didn't go in. Yeah. I mean, I heard about that, but I was speaking to someone from the OU, and they told me that it's not really dolphins, that if you search online and search for something called dolphin fish, it's like, it's a not kosher fish, supposedly. It's not kosher, right? Oh, it is a kosher fish? Oh, some... Oh, mahi mahi. Yeah, I actually just had some mahi mahi. Thank you. You know much better than me. Oh, man. So basically, yeah. I don't know. I mean, it would ruin the whole batch, yeah. I remember that when I was a kid. Was it that long ago? I mean, I'm 31, so I don't know. I remember when I was like 7, my mom like telling me. Yeah. Okay, let us finish up. So basically, he was also very, very... Yeah, we'll finish up. He was very, very active in Eretz Yisrael. In fact, when Rav Isser Zalman passed away, he actually became... They made a very weird arrangement. He was actually Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, something called Lakewood East, which is funny. It shows you in Eretz Yisrael to call something Lakewood East. It's really funny. A lot of brand recognition. It's very interesting. Rav Aaron used to go back. He used to go to Eretz Yisrael quite often. That's why, for example, the Satmar Rav, who was maspid him, he did give a eulogy about him in 1962, he did say about Rav Aaron that he totally disagreed about his activism for Eretz Yisrael. He was very much someone who, you know, where in Israel? In Yerushalayim. It's pretty crazy. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Oh, wait. Oh, I did not mean to do that. I want to show you guys this picture. Well, this will end, because there's two different things. Here, this is a great picture. You have Rav Soloveitchik all the way on the left, Rav Aaron Cutler in the middle, and Irving Bunim all the way on the right. And Irving Bunim wrote an amazing sefer called Ethics from Sinai. I highly suggest it. I like to go through it like once in a while, because like it's great learning a sefer from someone who's like not a rabbi and who really like who really put his money where his mouth is. Like, he was absolutely amazing. So if you take a look at this new book, it's called The Living Legacy of Rav Aaron. It's put out actually by Alan Dershowitz's cousin, who actually learned by Rav Aaron in Lakewood. If you find this picture, you will actually see that they actually took out, they photoshopped Rav Soloveitchik out of the picture on purpose, because they did not want anyone to know about this relationship. I find it very interesting, because I actually only buy this edition of Ethics from Sinai. The reason why is because the same thing also happened to Irving Bunim's Sfarim, that Feldheim, when they republished the Sfarim, they actually took out all references to any secular books. He quotes Shakespeare and I don't know, and all really interesting stuff. So they actually took it out, which is pretty sad. So let's get to the very last thing. Would Rav Aaron recognize Lakewood today? Would Rav Aaron recognize Lakewood today? So the idea I'd like to just leave with is no. The reason why is because Lakewood right now, up until a few years ago, a very affordable place to live. You could buy a gorgeous place. It's basically out in the country. But right now, if you go, just to give a very, very small indication of it, 10 years ago, it would have been impossible to find a restaurant with chairs in it. You were not able to sit. There was no such thing as a sit-down restaurant in Lakewood. And the reasoning was very much on purpose, because our time here is only spent for learning Torah, not for sitting down and eating. Right now, if you go to Lakewood, I was actually just recently there. I was there over the summer. Oh my, I'm telling you, you have your choice of Chinese, steakhouse, as many restaurants as the eye could see. It's really quite amazing. You have a lot of people moving there from Brooklyn. The entire town has changed, and you're starting to have a little bit of like a tension between like the older Lakewood people who really followed Rav Aaron and Rav Schneer and Rav Malkiel, and currently Rav Malkiel, who follow like this Lakewood Mesorah of like Torah only and really very, very much being isolated from like the general world. But now you're starting to have the same problems right now in the yeshiva, which is very funny, the same problems that went on in Klesk. What do I mean by that? I'll give one small example. The Hanhala of Lakewood came out and they said, you are not able to have an iPhone. You're unable to have an iPhone, which makes sense. They also came out, Rav Matisyahu Solomon, he came out and he said, you're not allowed to have Wi-Fi in the house. If you go around Lakewood with an iPhone, for example, and you're trying to look for, you know, For Wi-Fi, you will find the Wi-Fi everywhere. It's everywhere. If you go into Lakewood, I learned for the entire day there. It was awesome. You will see guys with iPhones. You will find guys. Some guys, I ran into a guy. He had a Samsung. He's like, they only said iPhones were us, sir. I don't think that's the point. I don't think it's like anti-Apple. But the point is that like Lakewood is very, very far away from the vision right now that Rav Aaron originally wanted to be. He wanted to be isolated. He wanted to be very, very much away from the general community. Now Lakewood is growing like you wouldn't believe. You could drive for 20 minutes. Now it's moving into Jackson. It's moving all over. So many Jews are moving into Lakewood. It is really quite amazing and beautiful to see so many Jews around. But the former idea of Aaron to keep it as a bastion of pure Torah, to keep it as a Torah-only place, I don't think that exists anymore. Thank you so, so much. I apologize.